I'm Christopher Lydon, stepping into yet another alternate universe of the odd genius who wrote A Clockwork Orange. Anthony Burgess thought his famous vision of modern mayhem was perhaps the least of his many novels. But what he really wanted, apart from all those books, was to be understood as well for the music he wrote. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is with the composer-conductor Paul Phillips about the mystery of words and music in general, and the strange and wonderful case in particular of Anthony Burgess, who liked to say he wished people knew him as a musician who wrote novels instead of as a novelist who made music on the side. The music we're speaking over right here is a Burgess Ballet Suite for Orchestra called Mr. W.S., as in William Shakespeare. Thank you, Paul Phillips, for getting us off our regular path and for connecting us with a lot of your passions, which are ours too. Cut to the chase with your own thought and Anthony Burgess's idea that for him, and maybe for all of us, it wasn't about words plus music, 2 + 2 gets you to 4, but about a single inseparable whole of imagination and expression.
Chris, that's exactly right. What distinguishes Burgess from so many other authors, and even those few authors who composed music as well as wrote novels, is that for him, these were two halves of one interconnected whole. And when I first became acquainted with Burgess's music, I didn't realize that. I thought he wrote symphonies and wrote operas and ballets and that they were separate entities. Then gradually I came to understand that almost every one of these works was connected in some way to a novel or a major literary work of Burgess's, and that they were conversely relatively few books of his that didn't have a very strong musical element. And so we have this interconnected whole, and what I've tried to do here is to illuminate the musical side, which in turn sheds light on the entire picture.
It's a brand new light for me, and I thought I knew Anthony Burgess. I'd read a lot of his books. I interviewed him. I admired him hugely. He was prodigiously learned and funny and common and regular, as well as one of the giants, surely, of late 20th century prose. But I was aware very vaguely. He wrote a novel called Napoleon Symphony, which I read once upon a time, that he had this interest in music. He wrote a wonderful book called This Man in Music, which I still remember. But I didn't realize that he had written A Clockwork Orange, for example, in sonata form. And I want you to explain that these things were incredibly integrated.
Burgess loved to say that novelists had a lot to learn from music and music composition, and then they could borrow musical form and musical structure and apply it to their writing.
What did he mean by that?
Well, he meant that you could take sonata form, for example, which you just mentioned. Sonata form is essentially an A-B-A structure. So in the first section, called the exposition, you set out your themes. In music, there are certain rules that generally apply to those themes. Burgess tried to transpose those same musical rules into literary sentences and structures. In the B section, you take certain of those themes from the exposition and you develop them in the development. And then in the return of the A section, musicians call it the recapitulation, you bring back all the themes from that first section. If you look at the novel, A Clockwork Orange, it's in three parts. Each part is 7 chapters long, and you realize that Burgess is really playing a game here. He's taken a set of themes, he's presented them in the first part. The B part, the development, is when Alex undergoes the Ludovico treatment, when he's in prison, and then when he undergoes the aversion therapy. And then when he comes out of prison, we're in the recapitulation. And if you if you've read the novel or you remember the movie, you remember that he encounters the same people that he encountered before.
Right.
He goes to home where the author is and where the terrible rape and attack takes place, except now it's turned on Alex. And the old man that he beats up in the first part, well, now the old man finds him and beats him up. So element by element, they're all brought back and they're transformed slightly. And the icing on the cake is the very last chapter. The coda is an essential part of the musical structure. And you look at the theme, what's it going to be then, A, which is that musical literary leitmotif that runs through the novel. So that's just one example. There are several books that Burgess wrote in musical form. You mentioned Napoleon Symphony. Napoleon Symphony was based on Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica. He based it in a very organized manner according to the duration of the movements of Beethoven, and he tried to find literary equivalents for certain chords, for certain sounds, for certain themes. It's very outrageous what he was trying to do. It was really probably the most Joycean literary experiment that he ever undertook. You know, Burgess was, to say that he loved Joyce and admired Joyce is really understating it. I mean, he was virtually obsessed with James Joyce for much of his life. And Napoleon Symphony, where he tried to follow in Joyce's footsteps. And that's another example of writing a book, a novel, that follows a musical form.
Paul Phillips, I'm so glad that you have been performing Burgess at Brown again, that you brought us back into the aura of this unbelievable, shall we say, Joycean master. But before we get to Joyce, go back to Mr. W.S. and the music we began with. Take that, characterize those sounds a little bit, the form, the meaning, not to mention the adulation of Shakespeare.
Well, Shakespeare was the other great influence on Burgess. Burgess wrote a novel, Nothing Like the Sun, a fictional account of Shakespeare's love life. Well, as in so many cases, to simply write a novel about that idea was not enough. So Burgess set out to write the music as well. So he decided he would turn it into a ballet. In this score, it's a pretty expansive score, 9 movements, and we hear a couple of different sides of Burgess. Burgess didn't have just one side of music that he composed, just like he didn't have just one type of writing that he wrote. The serious, fundamental Burgessian sound, if you want to call it that, I like to characterize as a mixture of his British influences. People like Walton is very important to him, Vaughan Williams, and especially Gustav Holst. He loved The Planets. That was one of his most favorite pieces. He loved Walton's First Symphony, everything by Vaughan Williams. He liked the music of Elgar very much, too. And we hear in Mr. W.S. the second movement sounds almost like Vaughan Williams might have written it. The last movement, the big march, has a Elgarian trio that sounds like it could have come from the Edwardian era. I like to think of Burgess's music as a kind of hybrid of Holst and Hindemith. It's got a early 20th century quasi-romantic pastoral English element, but it also has a little bit of Hindemithian modernity about it. And that's the serious side. You also get in Burgess, though, jazz. There are jazz elements, not in this particular piece, but many pieces have jazz and blues that come in sort of surprising ways. Sometimes a blues will erupt right out of a 12-tone row. He dabbled in 12-tone music. He wrote for all kinds of ensembles, choral, orchestral, chamber music, keyboard music, a lot of oboe music, recorder music. He wrote for the harmonica. He wrote for guitars. He wrote for guitar quartet. It's mind-boggling, really.
Paul Phillips, go back to the beginning with Anthony Burgess. What I remembered about him was that he was a Catholic from Manchester, must have had Irish roots, grew up in a very musical, working-class, earthy family, extended community. Surely that familiarity with instruments and lots of people who could play and sing were in on the formation here.
Absolutely. It formed part of his character. He liked to say that his parents met in a music hall. His father was an part-time pianist, amateur pianist, maybe made a little money on the side playing piano for silent films, and he played sometimes in the pit orchestras for music halls in Manchester. And he also played in the Golden Eagle Tavern, which was a tavern that Burgess's father ran with his second wife, Burgess's stepmother. So this tavern where there was all kinds of singing and piano playing, and they lived upstairs, and the young Anthony Burgess lived in that atmosphere and was surrounded by music, fell in love with music, but was almost completely self-taught. His father one day showed him where middle C was on the piano and said, "Okay, John, work it out from there." Never had piano lessons, never had composition lessons. He did it all himself.
Talk about as many pieces as we can fit in here among hundreds, a couple of hundred at least, that he wrote. I'm very much struck by the piano concerto. I wish you'd characterize it.
The piano concerto is a very ebullient piece. I mean, the pianist virtually attacks the piano. I mean, this is not any kind of polite music. There are big handfuls of chords. Some of them sound rather consonant. Some of them are dissonant. They're all over the keyboard. Big runs, glissando runs, white notes, black notes. First movement is more of a serious kind of a tone. And then as the piece, the second movement very much sounds almost like the Ravel piano concerto. It's very sweet, beautiful music in sixth. And then we get to the last movement, which is a series of dances. There's a polacca and a gavotte and a jig. And he throws these dances together. And then right in the midst of everything, it kind of stops, comes to a dead halt, and suddenly the piano starts playing the blues. You know, we now have a label for this. We call this postmodernism, where, you know, you scramble all these different ideas together and you don't feel that staying within one specific style is necessary anymore. Well, Burgess was way ahead of postmodernism. He was doing this in the 1970s before anybody was talking about this. And in his writing, too, you know, there are many, many things that we find in Burgess where now in the 21st century, we go back and go, wow, he was talking about that then, like when he was talking in his book 1985 about when the East and West would be battling it out over Islam and oil. He was talking about that 30, 40 years ago. Not too many people were at the time, but he was.
Speak of his choral music.
Well, Burgess wrote choral music. He wrote a few short pieces for a cappella chorus, SATB. He also wrote two very large-scale works. One is a setting of John Dryden, Ode for St. Cecilia's Day. It's a big work in eight movements for large orchestra, organ, SATB chorus, and SATB soloists. It's only been played once. We actually premiered it with the Brown University Orchestra up in Canada, in Montreal.
We've been listening to a series of piano pieces written from Master Cole. I want to listen, but tell us that story briefly.
Well, Master Cole is Samuel Cole, who lives right here in Providence, Rhode Island. Sam Cole is an English professor at Wheaton College. He visited Burgess. He mentioned to Burgess that he once, years ago, had taken piano lessons. Cole really wanted to talk about his novels. He was working on a book about Burgess's writing. And when he was getting ready to leave a few days later, after having had all these hours of interviews about the books, Burgess handed him the manuscript of this set of piano pieces, and that's what we've been listening to.
Speak a little bit about this quartet for flute, oboe, cello, and piano.
Yeah, this is an interesting piece. It's a very late piece. I don't know exactly what caused him to write this piece. Burgess did like to write for combination that included flute, oboe, and cello and piano. This was a combination that he came back to over and over, sometimes adding an additional instrument or a voice, but he seemed to have a real fondness for this particular combination. But this particular quartet, we don't know exactly why he wrote it, but I think it's one of his finest works, finest chamber works, and it's a great example, again, of this postmodern kind of style that Burgess loved, where he would throw in 12-tone music and blues and jazz and fugue, and it would all kind of come together in a marvelous way that seems to make perfect sense, but was really breaking the rules of music at that time when it was written.
He wrote a piece that he called Blooms of Dublin, as in Leopold Bloom and Joyce's Ulysses. Let's listen and then tell us what's going on.
many babies born.
Too many babies born. A fertile womb is a thing of gloom. Soon there won't be standing room.
Population without population. That is our need and our desire. May God preserve the condom, the pessary too, of course. The face in the name when we can slay the life force as its source. Masturbation means of procreation, but hasn't got the true erotic fire. Quintus interruptus is somewhat second grade. And as for God's said periods, it's often hard to wait. I'd rather sprinkle spermicide like pepper on my plate than copulate. Copulation without population is what every nation requires. Why should we fill our houses with messy squalling rats? We need a square inch we can spare for parodies and pass. Education is a variation that's causing all the alternative world.
Well, the song we've just listened to is one of my favorites from the show. It's called Copulation Without Population. And this Blooms of Dublin show harks back to the music hall life of his parents more than anything else that Burgess wrote. You know, he had this great affinity for Joyce. He loved Joyce. And he thought of Joyce not so much as the great modernist, but as a writer who could really depict Ireland and Dublin like nobody else. So what Burgess tried to do in Blooms of Dublin was not stress the difficulty of Joyce, but rather to stress the essential story that's embedded in Ulysses. And so this show is, I'd say it's closer to My Fair Lady than it is to what most people would imagine Joyce's Ulysses is like to read. And so here we hear this, it's almost like Doolittle's, you know, I'm Getting Married in the Morning. It's got that same kind of English music hall life to it and beat and rhythm. And this is part of what some of the people who first heard this show liked so much about it, that Burgess was unafraid to show everyday Dublin life in this show and in the music, while others who felt that Joyce is the great modernist and whatever music was composed has to be very difficult and very hard to understand.
But Joyce loved to sing, and he loved those classic Irish folk tunes.
Exactly, exactly. Joyce was a... you know, he lived through his ears very much. Joyce's wife, Nora, said that he just delighted in sound. And Burgess was also lived very much through his ears and through sound. You know, Burgess was entirely colorblind. And when he was about 12 or 13 years old and he first heard the music of Claude Debussy, the Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, the orchestral colors so delighted him that it was the turning point in his life. He felt that French music could provide an oral substitute for the visual colors that he was lacking.
Come back to this man we're talking about in the most general terms. When people think of Anthony Burgess's novels, I think they think of experimentation, certain prophecy, comedy, but a very dark variety, Englishness, modernity, violence, despite himself. How would you characterize the general direction of the music, or the general statement, so to speak?
I think the music is more conservative than the writing. Burgess took enormous liberties in writing in a book like Napoleon's Symphony, or even a book like Mozart and the Wolfgang, which is a very late work of his, written 2 years before he died. to celebrate Mozart's bicentenary in 1991. And this book was a hodgepodge of part film script, part dialogue, part play, part sort of musical, literary mashup in a way that was similar to Napoleon's Symphony. Every few pages, he just tries a new style to express some other aspect of Mozart. He was quite daring as a writer.
The who are you question. How did you, Paul Phillips, come to be so centered on Anthony Burgess, the composer? What's your story here?
Well, when Burgess died and the obituary in the New York Times mentioned many of the musical works that he'd composed, I became curious. I tried to find them. Didn't get anywhere, so I gave up on that idea. And then a few years later, in a kind of quirk of fate, a mutual friend of myself and of Leona Burgess came along, happened to wind up here in Rhode Island, mentioned that Leona Burgess, Burgess's widow, was looking for someone to organize his manuscripts. And the next thing I knew, I was on a plane flying to Monte Carlo, where I discovered these dozens and dozens of scores, and that's how it all started.
I'm wondering what you, as an artist and a performer, make of this synesthesia, this talent of blending the arts of many senses, eyes, ears, nose, and touch even.
Well, I admire it. I've always been intrigued by people who excel in more than one area. Look at somebody like the novelist, composer Paul Bowles. He was a successful composer, young composer in New York, writing songs and smaller pieces. Then he left and moved to Morocco and wrote The Sheltering Sky and became known as a novelist. Paul Bowles used to say that writing words and writing music were two totally separate compartments in his life. And when he entered into one compartment, he excluded the other. Burgess, on the other hand, totally integrated the two. And I think that's the fascinating part, and the way the novels and the music interacts. And there's even a synesthetic element to it. He writes about the tang of the oboe. There's a taste element that enters into when he describes the tone of the oboe and the sense of smell and the sense of taste that creeps in these descriptions. I think that Burgess did have synesthesia, and that the color blindness de-emphasized that element, some of the visual element. He even drew. He won an award for drawing as a boy.
Paul, make the connection which you do early in your book with Thomas Mann and Dr. Faustus, mid-century novel about a musical genius of whom Mann said, music and language, Levy-Kuhn insisted, belong together. We're fundamentally one. Language was music. Music, a language. And when separated, each always recalled the other, imitated the other, made use of the other's means, always to be understood as the substitute for the other.
Right, right. Well, I use that as the epigraph for the book because I think that represents Burgess so well. He called Dr. Faustus the greatest novel ever written about a creative artist. Wow. He was very aware of it. He alludes to Adrian Levy-Kuhn in his novel A Clockwork Orange, where he has another composer, German composer, named Adrian, who is a kind of hidden homage to Adrian Levy-Kuhn. And Adrian Levy-Kuhn in Dr. Faustus sets Shakespeare's Love's Labor's Lost. Well, Burgess sets Love's Labor's Lost in his Third Symphony. So there's a lot of resonance between Thomas Mann and Burgess. Burgess also considered writing an opera based on The Transposed Heads, which is a story by Thomas Mann. So he knew Thomas Mann's work very, very well. And I think that I don't think that Burgess sold his soul to try to become the next Adrian Leverkühn, but he certainly aspired to the kind of talent that Leverkühn succeeds in winning in that novel. Certainly there's a strong connection there.
It's such a pleasure to be reminded of kind of artistic talent at a completely different level. And surely Anthony Burgess was up there. Thank you, Paul Phillips. Thank you for this conversation, and thank you for this wonderful book, A Clockwork Counterpoint, The Music and Literature of Anthony Burgess.
Thank you, Christopher.
Give us a little traveling music, if you will.
Considering that we've just been talking about Thomas Mann and Burgess and their connection and Love's Labor's Lost, let's listen to the finale of Burgess's Third Symphony, where he sets Love's Labor's Lost for tenor, baritone, and orchestra, and even bases the whole movement on a six-note theme that Shakespeare wrote out in that same play.
It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.